The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading today from the December 6th, 2013 edition of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. The U.S. and Iran strike a deal. What happened? The Obama administration this week was strongly defending an international deal with Iran that would temporarily freeze Tehran's nuclear program in exchange for easing international sanctions, as critics at home and in Israel blasted the pact as an act of appeasement. The six-month agreement, a first step toward a long-term deal aimed at preventing Iran from building a nuclear weapon, calls on the Islamic Republic to stop enriching uranium beyond 5% purity, a level sufficient for use in energy plants, but not for bomb-making. Its stockpile of 20% enriched uranium, meanwhile, would be converted into a form that cannot readily be used for military purposes. Iran also agreed to halt work on its plutonium-producing Arak reactor and accept daily monitoring of its nuclear facilities by international inspectors. In return, the U.S. and five other participating nations agreed to provide up to $7 billion in sanctions relief. "We have a real opportunity to achieve a comprehensive, peaceful settlement," said President Obama. "I believe we must test it." Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu reacted furiously to the deal, which he said gave Iran concessions without forcing it to completely abandon all nuclear materials. He called the agreement a historic mistake that made the world a much more dangerous place, likening it to a deal that North Korea secretly violated on its path to building nuclear weapons. Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer echoed Netanyahu's stance and warned that Democrats and Republicans in Congress were considering defying the president to pass additional sanctions on Iran. What the editorial said: "The canyon-sized holes in Obama's deal make an Iranian bomb inevitable," said the Wall Street Journal. "The agreement lets the Islamic Republic keep its 10,000 operational centrifuges." Why does Tehran need so many centrifuges, if not to make a bomb at the time, any time it pleases? The mullahs are also allowed to continue enriching uranium to 5%, even though at that level it can be quickly converted into weapons-grade material. "Those issues will be addressed in any later, more comprehensive deal," said the New York Times. "Of course, there's no guarantee that such an agreement will ever be signed. In the past, Iran kept its nuclear program secret for nearly two decades before it was uncovered in 2002 and has resisted full disclosure of its activities. But if Iran cheats or fails to agree to a final deal, the ease sanctions can be quickly reversed and a new and tougher ones imposed." What the columnist said: "This time, Iran is serious about cutting a deal," said David Gardner in the Financial Times. "The country's economy is hemorrhaging because of sanctions. Inflation is at 40%, its currency is in free fall, and only a trickle of its oil is being exported. With discontent growing among its mostly young, secularized population, the regime knows it must curb its nuclear program and reintegrate with the world, or risk an Arab Spring-style uprising." "The mullahs are indeed on their knees," said Charles Krauthammer at the Washington Post, "which is why it's so foolish to ease sanctions now. If at this point of maximum economic pressure we can't get Iran to accept a final deal that shuts down its nuclear program, How in God's name do we expect to get such a deal when we have radically reduced that pressure? To expect total nuclear capitulation from the Iranians is naive, said Jeffrey Goldberg in Bloomberg.com. Having seen its neighbors Iraq and Afghanistan invaded by the U.S., the regime has decided that it is in its best long-term interest to be able to build a nuclear bomb at short notice. Skepticism is certainly warranted, said Albert Hunt, also in Bloomberg.com. But if the U.S. or Israel bombs Iran's nuclear facilities, Tehran and its Hezbollah allies could respond with a wave of terrorist attacks, igniting a regional Middle East war. That's why Obama and U.S. allies are gambling that the election of a moderate President Hassan Rouhani marks a real turning point and that Iran is willing to curtail its nuclear program, at least for now. It would be a less than perfect deal, but which alternative would be better? Our second main story, the Democrats go nuclear on the filibuster. What happened? Washington's bitter partisan divide erupted into open warfare last week after Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid took the nuclear option of eliminating filibusters for most presidential nominations. Reid's controversial move, which broke decades of Senate tradition, came after years of minority Republicans using filibusters to block President Barack Obama's judicial and executive appointments. Most notably, three nominees to the powerful D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. Traditionally, 60 votes were required to overcome such filibusters, but after last week's 52-48 vote, only a simple majority of 51 is needed to secure all appointments except Supreme Court nominees. The Senate is now expected to approve a series of stalled Obama nominations on party-line votes. In the history of the Republic, there have been 168 filibusters of executive and judicial nominations, said Reid. Half of them occurred during the Obama administration. These nominees deserve at least an up-or-down vote. Outraged Republicans attacked the rule change as a damaging and hypocritical power grab, pointing out that Democrats repeatedly used the filibuster against George W. Bush's nominees. You think this is in the best interest of the United States Senate and the American people? Asked Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. I say to my friends on the other side of the aisle, you'll regret this, and you may regret it a lot sooner than you think. What the editorial said. Democrats had little choice but to change the filibuster rule, said the New York Times. Though both parties are guilty of using the procedure, conservative senators have relentlessly abused it in the last 5 years, blocking dozens of perfectly qualified candidates. As a result, the National Labor Relations Board has been left crippled, while a staggering 20 of Obama's district court nominees were needlessly filibustered, compared with just 3 under all previous presidents. Reid's move will finally turn the Senate back into a functioning legislative body. Liberals will live to rue their decision, said the Wall Street Journal. The new rules only empower Democrats for as long as they control the White House and Senate, and set a precedent for Republicans to exploit it in the future. With bipartisan approval no longer a requirement, the next GOP president should line up outspokenly conservative judicial nominees like planes waiting to take off at O'Hare International Airport. The Democratic majority was justified in its grievance, but not in its rash action, said the Washington Post. The judiciary is now bound to get more extreme, the partisanship of Washington more poisonous, and American democracy that much poorer. What the columnist said. Democrats clearly have short memories, said Dana Milbank in the Washington Post. When a Republican Senate majority threatened to use a similar nuclear option to empower the majority in 2005, Liberals reacted with horror at the prospect of turning the consensual Senate into a clone of the mob-ruled House. But now that they're in power, said Megan McArdle in Bloomberg.com, those same Democrats, backed by Obama, are happy to scrap Senate tradition in order to pack as many liberal justices and appointees onto the courts and bureaucracies as they can. Obama's attempt to fill judicial vacancies with people of his choosing isn't packing, nor is it untoward or authoritarian, said Alec McGallis in NewRepublic.com. It's one of the age-old benefits of winning two elections in a row. What is unconstitutional is the GOP's brazen attempt to nullify his 2012 victory by preventing Obama from implementing his legitimate agenda. Now, Democrats can use that victory to their advantage, and yes, Republicans can, of course, do the same, if they win the presidency and the Senate in the future. But majority rule is not intrinsically democratic, said Eric Posner in Slate.com. It was the tyranny of the majority that produced Jim Crow laws in the South, remember? Filibusters had the virtue of forcing majority parties toward moderation, since extremist nominees were likely to be blocked. We won't see gridlock in this new nuclear wasteland of a Senate, but there will be clear losers, those in the center, meaning most of us. The controversy of the week, Obamacare. Does the GOP have a better alternative? Finally, said Robert Reich in HuffingtonPost.com, the Republican Party has a health care plan of its own. In a 17-page strategy document obtained last week by the New York Times, House Republican leaders are urging their members to take every opportunity to call Obamacare a disaster and find constituents who tell horror stories of canceled policies and soaring premiums. The goal is to frighten away the uninsured and then hopefully reap a huge electoral reward in the 2014 midterms. That plan, however, lacks one key component, an actual alternative to the Affordable Care Act. Though the White House botched the rollout of the ACA, Americans have absolutely no desire to return to the current travesty of a health care system. A new report last week from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development paints a bleak picture of that status quo, said Sarah Cliff in WashingtonPost.com. The U.S. currently spends 17.7% of its GDP on health care, while no other nation tops 12%. Our system spends a fortune on high-tech tests, but little on preventive care. As a result, the U.S. has the largest percentage of citizens who never see a doctor, and now ranks 26th in life expectancy, right behind Slovenia. Actually, there is a Republican alternative to Obamacare, said Yuval Levin and Ramesh Panuru in the Wall Street Journal. We need one so that if Obamacare collapses, whatever comes next isn't a further lurch toward a socialized single-payer system. The broad outline of a conservative plan, moreover, has been kicking around for decades. At its center is a universal tax credit to help every American buy health insurance. The tax credit would be the same amount for the uninsured as for those in employer-provided plans, to force employers to cut back on lavish coverage that drives up health care costs. It would enable people without coverage to get, without any real cost to them, catastrophic insurance providing coverage for major illnesses or injuries. Such a market-driven system would give every American incentive to buy basic health insurance without the coercion of the individual mandate and end up covering far more of those currently uninsured than even Obamacare at a much lower cost. That proposal is a serious start, said Andrew Sullivan in dish.andrewsullivan.com. But the devil's in the details. Helping the uninsured buy catastrophic insurance would still leave tens of millions of people paying out of their pockets to see doctors, meaning that most would still not get preventative care. Yes, people could choose to spend more of their own money for additional coverage or doctor visits, but when money is tight, people don't make rational choices about, say, spending $200 to get a cancer screening. Healthcare is one market where experts really do know better. That's why Obamacare mandates certain levels of coverage. Here's another interesting fact about the Republican alternative, said Ezra Klein in WashingtonPost.com. It would be even more disruptive to the status quo than Obamacare. By penalizing employers for offering comprehensive coverage and pushing everyone toward low-cost plans with high deductibles, conservatives would ask most Americans to pay far more for their medical care. The Republican alternative to Obamacare, in other words, is just a different kind of sweeping reform. That makes their campaign to whip up a political backlash against any change in current benefits the height of intellectual dishonesty. No wonder most Republicans are sticking with the slogan of repeal and mumble. We turn now over to the best columns in the U.S. The first comes from Juan Williams at FoxNews.com. Now we see the real Zimmerman. I told you so, said Juan Williams. George Zimmerman sure doesn't look like an innocent victim now, does he? The former Neighborhood Watch volunteer who claims he shot 17-year-old Trayvon Martin in self-defense has repeatedly proved himself to be a guy with serious anger issues, who likes to use guns to threaten people. Last week, Zimmerman was charged with aggravated assault after allegedly putting a gun in his girlfriend's face and shoving her out the door of her own apartment. He told cops the girlfriend threatened him. Just a few months earlier, his estranged wife told police Zimmerman threatened to shoot her, punched her elderly father in the face, and destroyed her iPad to erase photos of his rampage. Obviously, Zimmerman is not the Second Amendment poster boy of conservatives' imagination. He's the liar and angry loser prosecutors described, who probably threatened Martin with his gun and provoked the fight that ended the teen's death. Liberals were wrong in ascribing that killing to racism. Zimmerman appears to be a threat to people of all colors. From Philip Klein at WashingtonExaminer.com, in 2016, Walker could beat Christie. Scott Walker could be Chris Christie's worst nightmare, said Philip Klein. Though pundits have already anointed New Jersey's governor as the GOP presidential frontrunner for 2016, Walker has compiled an even more impressive record as Wisconsin's governor and is more authentically conservative. Like Christie, he's won in a traditionally Democratic state and is revered by a broad swath of conservatives for his bruising battle with the Wisconsin Teachers Union. The Tea Party wing of the party that's suspicious of moderates genuinely respects Walker for his consistent fiscal and social conservatism. On a gut level, conservatives would say that he is one of us, while they view Christie warily. Walker's personality is another plus. He's soft-spoken and self-effacing, and in Iowa, New Hampshire, and other states, primary voters may find Walker's Midwestern humility more appealing when placed against Christie's in-your-face Jersey attitude. Christie's strongest argument for the nomination is that he can win over blue states. But if Walker can win a bruising re-election battle in 2014, he can say the same. If Walker runs in 2016, he could instantly supplant Christie as the GOP's most likely nominee. And from Michael Tomosky at thedailybeast.com, the price of ignoring mental illness. The saddest thing about the family tragedy of Virginia State Senator Cray Deeds is that it was preventable, said Michael Tomosky. Deeds was repeatedly stabbed in the head and chest last week by his mentally ill son, Gus, who then committed suicide. Gus Deeds should have been in a psychiatric ward, but health workers couldn't find a psychiatric bed for him anywhere in a wide area of Virginia. That's probably because Virginia cut funding for psychiatric beds by 15% between 2005 and 2010, and is now considering deeper cuts. Tragically, this is a nationwide trend. States cut $4.35 billion for mental health services between 2009 and 2012, even though 10% more people sought care during that period. The U.S.'s per capita psychiatric bed population is now the same as it was in 1850. Yes, 1850, around when the very idea of caring for mentally ill people first started. When budgets get tight, psychiatric care is always one of the first things on the chopping block. Who cares about the mentally ill and their families? As a result of this indifference, Gus Deeds is dead, and his father, though alive, is heartbroken. Shame on us all. On the briefing page this week, the battle for the Arctic. As the Arctic ice retreats further and further, world powers are rushing to tap the region's riches. Why is the Arctic changing? Global warming is melting the ice sheet covering the top of the world. The amount of ice during the summer months has declined more than 40% since the 1970s, a trend that most climate scientists say is a consequence of man-made greenhouse gas emissions. By as early as 2030, some researchers believe, the Arctic could have ice-free summers. Climate change is actually doing what our worst fears dictated, said Jennifer Francis, a sea ice expert at Rutgers University. But for countries that border the Arctic, the melt offers big benefits. New shipping lanes between Europe and the Pacific are opening up. Vast amounts of oil and natural gas that were once locked beneath ice can now be exploited. How much oil and gas is there? The Arctic Circle covers about 6% of the Earth's surface, but could hold as much as 20% of the world's undiscovered hydrocarbon resources, according to the U.S. Geological Survey. That includes 90 billion barrels of oil, or about as much oil as the entire U.S. uses over 12 years, and even more natural gas, about a third of the world's untapped reserves. As the ice has retreated, energy companies have moved in, even though it's not yet clear which nations own these resources. Royal Dutch Shell has spent more than $4.5 billion searching for oil off Alaska's coast since 2005. And U.S. giant ExxonMobil has signed an exploration deal with Russia, as have Britain's BP, Norway's Statoil, and Italy's Eni. Not everyone in the industry supports this rush north. Christophe de Margerie, chief executive of French oil giant Total SA, warns that the risk of drilling in this extreme environment are too high, and that a spill in this pristine wilderness would be a disaster. Why is it so hard to drill there? In summer months, gale force winds move giant flows of ice that can tear through the sides of oil rigs or rip up undersea pipelines. And in winter, when daylight is minimal and temperatures drop as low as minus 50, much of the region becomes covered with sea ice and is inaccessible. Amid such hazards, said Simon Boxall, a British oil spill expert, it is inevitable you will get a spill. Capping broken wells in winter would be difficult, if not impossible. And cleanups in the harsh conditions would pose unprecedented challenges. What if there's a leak? Shell has developed a 20-foot-tall steel containment dome, which can be lowered onto a leaking well head and funnel oil to a tanker on the surface. But in a sea test last year, the dome malfunctioned and was crushed like a beer can by water pressure, according to government documents. Industry officials argue that the Arctic's freezing waters could actually help with the cleanup as oil breaks down slowly in cold temperatures, giving more time to skim the spill from the surface. But environmentalists say that during the 2010 spill in the calm waters of the Gulf of Mexico, the industry managed to skim only 3% and burn 5% of the spilled oil. Much of the remainder sank to the ocean floor, where it was digested by bacteria. Those bacteria aren't as plentiful in the Arctic. A Shell official says that in the Arctic, it would be rather ridiculous of us to make any kind of performance guarantee. Who owns the Arctic? That's very unclear. Under the 1982 United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, coastal nations have exclusive rights to underwater resources up to 200 miles from their own shore. They can extend that claim by proving the seabed in a particular area is an extension of their continental shelf. Russia, Denmark, and Canada are all seeking to claim ownership of the Lomonosov Ridge, a 1,200-mile underwater mountain range that runs through the Arctic Ocean. The U.S. has been left out of this jockeying since the Senate has refused to ratify the treaty, fearing it would cede American sovereignty to the U.N. Until we ratify that treaty, we will remain on the sidelines in the Arctic, said Heather Conley, a fellow at Washington Center for Strategic and International Studies. In case boundary disputes cannot be settled peacefully, Canada and Russia are preparing to defend their claims militarily. What steps are they taking? Canada is investing $3 billion in a fleet of offshore patrol ships and is developing unmanned drone aircraft that can cope with the region's freezing temperatures. Russia, meanwhile, is restoring a Soviet-era base off Siberia, and recently sent a warning to foreigners not to interfere with its Arctic interest by jailing the 30-member crew of a Greenpeace ship who protested at an offshore platform. Both countries have also staged military exercises at their northern borders, with the Russians recently sending 10 warships to patrol Arctic waters. The 21st century will see a fight for resources, said Dmitry Rogozin, Russia's former ambassador to NATO. Russia should not be defeated in this fight. Opening the Northwest Passage. For centuries, traders have dreamed about sailing ships through the ice-choked Northwest Passage, a shortcut from the Atlantic to the Pacific that runs across Canada's north coast. With ice cover shrinking due to global warming, that fabled sea lane is now open for business. Last September, the Nordic Orion, an ice-strengthened carrier hauling coal from Vancouver to Finland, became the first major commercial vessel to make the voyage, cutting 1,000 miles off its normal route through the Panama Canal and saving $80,000 in fuel. Still, the risks of traveling the Northwest Passage will remain substantial for the foreseeable future. Michael Byers, author of International Law in the Arctic, notes that small, hard-to-spot icebergs have been known to puncture even fortified hulls. Then there is icing, he said, which occurs when ocean spray freezes onto the superstructure of a ship, causing it to become top-heavy and capsize. The Panama Canal, he says, will not lose many customers. Turning now to the last word. Green is the color of money. Recycling isn't just a noble pursuit, said Alan Minter. It's a profit-driven business. Recycling is not the most glamorous work, and it's generally not the sort of thing that politicians and environmentalists discuss when they discuss green jobs. But for the right person, it's an opportunity as endless as anything dreamed up by Silicon Valley. Alan Bachrach is the right kind of person. As a director of recycling for Waste Management Corporation, North America's largest recycler of household waste, he has a professional, profit-driven interest in recycling. If there are those who feel shame for working in an industry that handles other people's waste, Alan Bachrach isn't one of them. He loves it. We meet early in the visitors area of Waste Management's new recycling plant in Houston. Bachrach's eyes don't focus on me, but rather on what's on the other side of a plate glass window and two stories down, swiftly moving Class A rapids of plastic bottles, cardboard, and paper, riding up and down conveyors over and under, around and around, until they emerge as perfectly sorted hay bale-sized blocks of bottles, cardboard, and paper tied together with steel ties. Waste Management's single-stream recycling plant sorts between 600,000 and 700,000 pounds of recycling per day. That's roughly the weight of an Airbus A380 jet, measured out in newspapers, plastic milk jugs, beer cans, and shoeboxes. When I asked for an estimate of just how many households those pounds represent, Alan tells me that, on average, a Houston family generates 50 pounds of single-stream recycling per month. You ready to take a walk? Alan asks me with a childlike gleam. We walk outside and around the building to an enclosed receiving area where a truck is tipping a load of recycling onto the concrete floor. Single-stream recycling hisses more than it clanks, mostly due to the fact that 70% of it is paper. Junk mail, newspaper, office paper. A front-end loader of the sort most people are accustomed to seeing dig in the dirt at construction sites rolls up and digs into this mass of well-intentioned waste, picks it up, and dumps it into a device that feeds the stuff onto conveyors. We enter into the Walmart-sized space that I saw from above, and I swear the first thing that comes to mind is Willy Wonka's chocolate factory. Conveyors of trash rush upward and release their cargo into spinning stars that toss it about in a manner that I can only describe as joyful, like popcorn jumping in a frying pan. Some continues along, some drops away. I see detergent and shampoo bottles zipping by, and I see milk bottles dropping, from points unknown, into a giant cage. We climb a stairway to what Alan calls the pre-sort. Here, two workers stand over a high-speed conveyor that carries freshly arrived, unsorted recycling. One of them reaches out and grabs a brown plastic bag from the blur, and just as quickly it disappears, sucked up by a large vacuum tube positioned directly above them. Then he does it again. Not everybody can hack this job, Alan leans over to say, nodding at the speeding blurry line. Some people get dizzy, throw up. One of the sorters grabs a hunk of something. It happens so fast I can't tell what, and drops it down a square chute. The other job is to pull out big pieces of plastic and trash, he adds, and points me farther along to the spinning stars I saw from below. The conveyor feeds into the stars, and newspaper bounces and froths atop them like white water on churning waves. The stars, they're made of a specialized plastic that wears well, are spaced at intervals to allow plastic, glass, and aluminum to fall down onto another line. The newspaper, meanwhile, dances right across the stars and emerges at the other end, separated. Meanwhile, below, the material that dropped through the stars, including more paper, is conveyed into yet more stars, spaced at smaller intervals that convey out even more paper in smaller sizes, while the plastics, glass, and cans continue to fall away. It's a cascade, each step angled steeper than the last, and at each level, paper and plastic are separated. Below, aluminum cans are literally ejected from the system by a device that creates an electrical current that repulses metals. The glass, meanwhile, is removed by several processes that take advantage of the obvious fact that glass is heavier than paper. Think of it this way. If you place a beer bottle next to a pile of newspaper coupons and aim a hairdryer at both, you'll likely be left with only a beer bottle. That's a rough approximation of the physics that waste management uses to separate the two materials. We climb more stairs, moving ever higher into the system. There's no more paper up this high. Now it's all about separating the different kinds of plastics. "This is my guy's favorite one," Alan tells me, and he nods at a yellow device that hangs over a blur of bottles. It contains 200 sensors that shine infrared light onto the trash passing beneath them. When the light reflects off, say, a Red Tide detergent bottle, nothing happens. But if the light reflects off a clear Coca-Cola bottle, the computer records exactly where it is on the precisely timed conveyor. Through the clamor, I hear irregular sharp pops of compressed air, like tiny gun bursts. A few feet from the sensors, I see an Aquafina bottle stagger backward onto another conveyor, followed by a Coke bottle. The computer knows exactly where the bottles are and how long it takes for them to arrive at the air guns. I can see the nozzles now, tiny needle tips capable of sending an empty bottle flying. According to Alan, this one machine, its sensors and air guns, replaces 6 to 10 manual sorters. Still, infrared light sensors, for all of their sophistication, have limitations. One of them, according to Alan, is that they can't sort white polyethylene bottles from colored polyethylene bottles. In layman's terms, that's the process of sorting a Red Tide detergent bottle from a white Minute Maid orange juice bottle. But have no fear. We have the most sophisticated equipment available. A person. Sure enough, three human beings stand over a conveyor, grabbing the white bottles and tossing them down chutes. At their best, people can handle perhaps 45 sorts per minute. Not bad, but certainly not nearly the hundreds that an array of air guns and sensors can handle. For all of Alan's joking about people as technology, however, he never once diminishes the dignity of the work done by his sorters. Like many of the scrap entrepreneurs I've met over a lifetime around this industry, he identifies with them. After all, they're in the business of sorting other people's waste. People think that because these are minimum wage jobs or close to minimum wage jobs, it's a very high turnover position. I've got 10, 15, 20-year folks. It may not be the highest-paying job, and it may not be glamorous or the sort of thing that your kid will want to tell his friends about. But if you're looking for a consistent job with benefits where layoffs are almost unknown, then it doesn't get much more consistent than American recycling. In Houston, a town that knows the heartbreak of boom and bust better than most areas, a stable job like this is worth more than just a salary. You won't find a Chinese version of Alan Bachrach. Just as you won't find an Indian, Kenyan, Vietnamese, or Jordanian one either. The reason is that most of the world remains poor enough to justify employing people to do what Alan does with star screens and air guns. Consider what happens every night in the courtyard of the Shanghai high-rise where I live. Just past midnight, you'll likely hear the clank of a bottle bouncing across concrete. If you follow that bounce back to its source, you'll come to a concrete hut, not much larger than a single-car garage, from which fragrant trash has been spilled several feet into the narrow asphalt road. It doesn't look like American trash. There are few boxes, cans, or bottles. Rather, it's mostly food waste, peels, husks, bones. Move a little closer and you might see two or three hunched shadows atop the oozing mess, canvas bags swung over their shoulders, scrounging through it with bare hands, searching for metal cans, plastic bottles, or perhaps something better yet, a stray coin. They're not Shanghaiese, but often families of poor migrants from farms in the less wealthy provinces, making the best living they can. Families that pick through trash in the middle of the night are just the last screen in a profit-driven process that, if you wait outside my building through the night, begins at the gate at first light. There you'll see a squat and brawny migrant woman wearing a fanny pack stuffed with small money and carrying a small hand scale. If anyone is the Chinese equivalent of Alan Bachrach, presiding over a system that harvests recyclables from the trash, she is it. Her destination is the pile of cardboard tied with twine that's weighted beneath the night watchman's gaze, and a waist-high balance scale of the sort you might find in a doctor's office. As she pulls out the big scale, the early rising old ladies in my building wander downstairs carrying a few plastic bottles, perhaps a small cardboard box or two, and maybe a small plastic bag filled with cans. The bottles and cans are priced individually. The boxes are attached to a small hook on the hand scale and weighed. Payment is equivalent to a few pennies, which the early risers take to the wet market in search of the day's vegetables. Morning brightens, and the recycling lady is joined by her slight husband. While he handles the walk-up transactions, his wife ventures up into my building, responding to dispatches relayed through the guard booth. Somebody bought a television and wants the big box in which it was delivered removed. Through the morning, she rides up the elevator, up and down, paying a few pennies, the market price, for whatever's available for recycling. Men on bicycles that pull small trailers begin to arrive. Some are there to buy newspapers, others cans. Whatever it is they want, they pay more for it than what she paid for it in the building. Then tie the goods to their trailers and pedal off. Before the end of the day, they'll sell the collections to small scrap company, one with a warehouse rather than a street corner. But the concept is the same. Buy low and sell high. At the scrap company, scrap is combined into bigger loads that can be sold to paper mills, aluminum smelters, and other manufacturers in need of raw materials. There's no need for single-stream schemes to raise the recycling rate in Chinese cities because, in the end, my Chinese neighbors have something that most Americans don't. A recognition that the recycling is worth more than virtue. It's worth money. This was taken from Junkyard Planet, Travels in the Billion-Dollar Trash Trade, by Adam Minter, M-I-N-T-E-R, published 2013. On the Health and Science page, seeking clues to a Martian mystery. NASA has launched another spacecraft bound for Mars, this time with the goal of unraveling the mystery behind the planet's evolution from a warm, wet environment to the cold, dry landscape it is today. The Mars Atmosphere and Volatile Evolution Mission, or MAVEN, will arrive at its destination in September 2014, following a journey of more than 440 million miles. Unlike the rover's Curiosity and Opportunity, MAVEN will not explore the Martian surface, but will remain in a lopsided orbit and focus on analyzing the Martian atmospheres. Scientists will use data collected on trace gases from different altitudes to model how the Martian climate changed over billions of years. It's already known that the atmosphere was once dense enough to support liquid water, as evidenced by geological features such as dried-up riverbeds. Current theory holds that solar wind and cosmic radiation stripped away much of the atmosphere after the planet's protective magnetic field switched off long ago. But MAVEN will dig deeper to see if that's true. The biggest unanswered question, NASA Science Mission Director John Grunsfeld tells the Associated Press, is whether Mars ever supported life. We don't have that answer yet. And that's all part of our quest for trying to answer, are we alone in the universe? He said. The health scare of the week, birth control pills and glaucoma. Women who used birth control pills for 3 years or more had twice the risk of developing glaucoma, a leading cause of blindness. That's the sobering conclusion of a new study analyzing data from 3,400 women ages 40 and older by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which more than doubles previous estimates of such risk. Birth control pills lower women's levels of the hormone estrogen, which is thought to have a protective effect on the eye, possibly making it more susceptible to glaucoma's damage to the optic nerve. But researchers stress that the new data confirms only an association, not a direct cause. And even at the highest risk estimate, the chance of women getting glaucoma after 40 remains a little under 4%. Still, if you've been using oral contraceptives for a long time, that may be enough indication for you to get screened for glaucoma, University of California, San Francisco ophthalmologist Shan Lin tells NPR.org. Glaucoma affects 60 million people worldwide, and while there are treatments to slow its progression, there is no known cure. One of our talking point articles this week, The Marines, When Women Pass the Test. By any measure, last Thursday was a historic day for the military, said Craig Whitlock in the Washington Post. For the first time, three women completed the Marine Corps' grueling combat training course, an intensive 59-day challenge of their physical and psychological strength and endurance. But while the women carried the same rifles and lugged the same 85-pound packs on the same 12-mile hikes as their male counterparts, they won't be allowed to serve in an infantry unit for at least another 2 years. Instead, they'll be assigned to staff and support jobs while the Pentagon studies the effects of integrating women into combat roles. This foot-dragging is frustrating women warriors, said David S. Cloud in the Los Angeles.Time. When the military lifted the ban on women in combat in January, it was partly in recognition that many female soldiers already technically saw combat in Iraq and Afghanistan. But women are still being excluded from coveted combat roles that are crucial for advancement up the ranks. The battlefield is no place for gender-based quotas, said Elaine Donnelly in the Washington Times. The Pentagon claims that training will be the same for men and women, but the Marines quietly introduce gender-normed scores to enable women to pass tests requiring upper body strength. Women, for example, get the same score for 5 pull-ups that men get for 20. The Marines have admitted that, on average, women have 47% less lifting strength, 40% less muscle strength, and 20% less endurance capacity than men. In close combat with a ruthless enemy, women do not have an equal opportunity to survive, and their relative weakness puts their comrades' lives at risk, creating huge morale problems. Generals who ignore these facts are dissembling shamelessly. What's really keeping women out of the infantry isn't the weakness of women, said William Salatin in Slate.com. It's the weakness of men. Last year, 17% of male Marines said they'd leave the Corps if women were offered combat roles, saying they worried about female soldiers getting preferential treatment or falsely accusing them of sexual harassment. Just call them the few, the proud, the insecure. Granted, only a small percentage of women can pass the grueling standards for combat, but if they prove they can hack it, how can the military justify excluding them? Here is a little blurb from Only in America. A McDonald's website for employees suggested that they return unwanted gifts and sell possessions to bring in some quick cash during the holiday season. The McResource site also encouraged the company's minimum wage employees to break food into smaller pieces to feel more full, and to stop complaining because it increases stress. It was a good week for Hillary Clinton, who was paid $450,000 to make a single speech to the Chicago Mercantile Exchange's Global Financial Leadership Conference in Naples, Florida, according to the Chicago Sun-Times. It was a good week for closing your car windows after Wisconsin highway officials began testing a salty, smelly byproduct of cheese making known as cheese brine to de-ice the state's roads. "I don't really mind the odor," said highway worker Emil Norby, who came up with the idea. "Our roads smell like Wisconsin." It was a good week for college pranks after a group of Harvard University students sneaked onto Yale's campus and gave fake tours to prospective students. The guides told touring families that Yalees are stupider, less successful, and less attractive than their Harvard peers. It was a bad week for Mick Jagger after the Rolling Stones singer, age 70, discovered that he is going to be a great-grandfather. "I'm not sure he likes the idea of getting old or being called great-granddad," said his pregnant granddaughter, Assisi, age 21. It was a bad week for squeezing the fruit after poisonous black widow spiders were found on grapes in several supermarkets across the Midwest. "I saw the legs moving frantically," said one Wisconsin shopper. "I thought, that is a very big spider." It was a bad week for ignoring your alarm clock after a Connecticut woman admitted phoning bomb threats to three courthouses because she was running late and wanted to postpone her hearing on a minor criminal charge. Jennifer Chirico, 31, now faces up to 10 years in jail. A couple of notes. The 113th Congress is on course to pass less legislation than any Congress in history. So far, it's passed only 49 laws. The Do-Nothing Congress, denounced by President Harry Truman in 1947, passed 906 laws. The number of college students in the U.S. fell by 2% this year, compared with last, a decline caused by a combination of demographics, a tepid economy, and high tuition costs. The decline is likely to continue, since the number of new high school graduates peaked in 2011 and isn't predicted to return to that level until 2024. At least 3,278 Americans are serving life sentences without parole for such nonviolent crimes as cursing at a policeman and selling $10 worth of drugs. More than 80% of these life sentences are the result of mandatory sentencing laws. When it sells its remaining stock in General Motors, the U.S. government will make a net $10 billion profit on its $421.6 billion bailout of the financial and auto industries. 5 years after the bailouts began, the stock market has hit a record high, and the U.S. auto industry has added more than 300,000 jobs. On the poll watch, 63% of uninsured Americans who have visited a state or federal health care exchange describe the experience as negative or very negative. 34% said it was positive or very positive. 63% of Americans say they support legislation to create a pathway to citizenship for immigrants who entered the U.S. illegally. 18% want those immigrants to be identified and deported. And a quote here from Stephen King. Talent is cheaper than table salt. What separates the talented individual from the successful one is a lot of hard work. And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's program. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.